Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. For those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about our guest because this is a little bit different than many of our shows. But I got to tell you, I've been so excited about reading her work. So our guest's first novel is called Who Needs Paris? And it was called one of the best indie books in 2023 by Kirkus Reviews, a prestigious literary magazine. Joan Meyerson's career was spent as an award-winning writer, director, and producer of documentaries and television programs, including the PBS National Memorial Day Concert, for which she won two Writers Guild of America awards. The dynamic accounts that she wrote about vets and military families reconfirmed her belief that the best stories came from real life, a belief she has followed in writing such varied programs as Zoo Life with Jack Hanna and Children of Japan for Disney. Now, having told the stories of others, she now tells one of her own in Needs Paris, inspired by the times that she herself lived there. Now, as someone who grew up in the 60s, although there are some, my children for starters, that would question the term grew up in relation to me, I found this novel to be sexy, fun, and as much a testament to the current affairs of life in the 70s in the U.S., as well as a rich page-turning account of Paris in the 60s and 70s. Now, I was glad to hear that Joan is busy finding more stories in her Valley Forge neighborhood, which would be Los Angeles to those of you that don't live in Southern California. Joan, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here. Oh, and by the way, it is Valley Village. We haven't quite made the forge part yet.
We're not. Oh, did I say forge? And you know what? I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I guess I was. I was off in another.
The valley, the San Fernando Valley.
That's yes, but
North
but,
Hollywood.
And I know Valley Village, and I know a lot of people don't know. And actually, a dear friend, an actor, lived there for many years, and so I used to visit him there. So,
yeah,
but. Anyway, before we get started, now, I want to share an observation that I made about your book, Who Needs Paris? But first, to put it in context, I have to tell a little story about myself that few people know. The first script that I wrote, which was about 15 years ago, was with a writer who had wrote for Disney in the 70s and 80s. Now, I shared the script with a friend who had produced plays and a TV show, who also has autism, which kind of means he doesn't have a filter. His response was, great concept, big problem. It obviously was written by two old white guys who do not understand the dialogue of today's young people. Wow. That hit me. But I loved it. I was so thankful that knowing that he is incredibly truthful, but I learned something. You know, I learned how important that was, and I learned I needed a lot more work on writing. But I bring this up because I found that Who Needs Paris to be so well written on so many levels, and that jumping between multiple countries and time periods, I found the dialogue to brilliantly fit each to a T. So I just wanted to share that with you before we go into questions, because that was one of my observations.
Thank you. That's really sweet of you to say. And I don't know. It is true that it took me a little while to get there. I think I had to really realize, too, each chapter, you know, when you start with the chapter and you're in with the chapter, you want to bring that person right back into it so they don't get confused. I mean, we would have at the top of the chapter what year it was, but most, a lot of readers, when you're reading, you know, you don't look at that at the top. So
right.
I always tried to make sure that the chapter before would end with a little bit of a cliffhanger, mm-hmm. but a cliffhanger that would lead into what the next chapter would be, even though it was 13 years later, but there would be some kind of reference back to it. And so the reader could just slip right back into that, back into the old part, the old part, the 60s
Well,
part.
As I was saying, you know, as a fellow baby boomer, there's terminology that's used that I just felt at home. I was like, yes, that's exactly how we spoke then.
Yeah. Well, some things never leave you, right? You know?
Exactly. Well, it was a good reminder.
Of how we spoke, yeah. Well, yeah. Also, one of the things that helped me, I must admit, is that I'm sort of a pack rat. And starting at the time I was very young, I had a big box. I would get a letter from somebody or a postcard or a diploma, you know, from my junior high school, or when I ran for election in high school, I'd have a little poster. And, you know, there were things that was hard to throw away. And so I would just toss it into a box, and there it would sit for years and years and years. And so when I'm trying to go back to 1964, and even 1977, I started going through this box, and I found letters that I had written to friends and friends had written to me, and various things that took me right back to those times. And so that really helped, was really helpful. So even though people say don't be a pack rat, I think there's some benefits to it.
Well, in this case, I think it certainly helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, well, let's talk about the book. And I think the best way to start is, you know, what was your inspiration with doing all of the things that you were doing that you thought, okay, I'm now going to write a novel? Or was writing Who Needs Paris for you sort of a way of maybe sorting out your own past?
Well, you know, you kind of, I say, could say you hit the nail on the head, but there's two nails here because both are true. Both are true. I think both of those, as I lived those periods in the 60s and then again in the 70s, they were both at the time sort of monumental to me. They really did make a difference in my life. And there were journals that I had written about them, sort of diaries, you know, that again went in that big box. And I kept thinking about how, you know, it was a good story, you know. It was not mm-hmm. just my life, but it was a good story. And especially the one in the 60s before I did the 70s. And I did try writing a short story at that time about the 60s, but I wasn't proficient enough. I don't think I was at that time. I was just learning how to make documentaries. And it just, anyway, it ended up going in my drawer and didn't really do anything about it. And then the 70s happened, and that, as I say, was a monumental time in my life, too. And but I continued working in documentaries or doing other things. I even wrote some animation for an animated series and a children's pilot called The Magic Land of Zoe, where you don't go when you don't go to Oz, you go to Zoe. And then the National Memorial Day concert, you know. So the more that I was doing these things, the more I was talking to people and getting their stories. And there came a time when I thought, what is it going to be the next stage of my life? And I realized that I've been telling stories of other people and loving doing that. But I had stories of my own to tell, too. And I didn't know, though, should I do a novel? I felt like I wanted to just try a novel. I never had done that before. But should I do the novel on the 60s or should I do the novel on the 70s? Both had interesting things. You know, the 70s were brighter and lighter and sexier, maybe you might say, but and show busy. And but the 60s had their own, you know, interesting time, and also it was a time for my character, Kate, who had gone, you know, gone through a love affair and had a traumatic time and so on. But I just didn't know which one to do. And then it suddenly occurred to me that one could not happen without the other, you know. As Shakespeare said, the past is prologue. And the only way you could really understand what happened in the 70s is what happened in the 60s, what happened in the 60s was so relevant to her that it had to be dealt with in the 70s. And so that's how I decided to do it, that it was something that I should do. And as you said, as time went on and I was writing, I hadn't thought about it at the time, but as time went on and I was writing all these stories that were inspired by real life, I found sometimes, you know, when there had been a crisis in my life and I had to be realistic about it or emotional about it, I might make it turn out the way I wanted it to have turned out instead of the way it really did. So it turned out that was the therapy part, you know, where I had to finally face some of the things that have been difficult for me and find a way out of them. And it was the best really was the best therapy I've ever had.
Well, I love the way that you did it. And I love the jumping back and forth. And I think if you would have done it chronologically, I don't think that it would have been as captivating. We wouldn't have still been, because with each chapter, you know, I'm now going back into that. But because it jumps back, I don't forget what's happened in the prior one. So it's sort of as if I'm enjoying two stories at once, but I'm also seeing how they blend. Anyway, I've enjoyed it. Now, one of the questions that I had in my mind while I was reading it was the initial, the beginning, in the 70s with the sex documentary, that Kate is dealing with. Mm-hmm. How close is that to something that you had to deal with?
Oh, God. Well, I have to admit, it was true. It's true. I mean, how could anyone even have thought about that? The wildest dreams, would you've ever, made that up? It's just...
That was kind of my thought as I was reading it. I'm going, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah. And I don't know, because that was something that really stuck in my mind. I mean, and there was a producer, a French film director that I had freelance for, and we had done lots of different things. And he, some things were kind of fun, but this was, this one was, went a little further out than some of the other ones. One of the things he had done was that we covered the Chippendale Dancers. Do you remember them? Mm-hmm. That was a new thing in the 70s, and we did that. And he found a place where there was an apartment building that was all for nudists, so that cover that. And that's who he was. He was French. What can I say? he had a little more fun with that one, but it was true. Yes, it was true. And I found myself caught up in this whole thing. I just thought, like I said, I felt like I'd fallen down the rabbit hole, how could this be?
Well, I think we're going to find that we may have crossed paths at some point in time in real life, mm-hmm. because as you're talking about that, when I was just coming up and starting as a young detective, mm-hmm. Someone who is one of my best friends in the world to this day, but at that time was an investigator who also was working in Hollywood. He was producing a documentary on Chippendales.
maybe you were there the night we were there.
I was going to say he had a trailer there. While they were shooting, and he had a lot of wild stories about what was going on.
It's true. It's interesting. But I also, I guess, I think you are too, a curious soul. I mean, I always learn about everything. And so even if it's really kind of strange and weird, I think, whenever I'm going to ever have a chance to really see this again or learn about this. And so you kind of put on, maybe that comes from making documentaries. I don't know. You want to observe
Well, I think another thing that comes from making documentaries that you're not only telling a story, but you're also educating. And I think that maybe that comes from that as well, because what I noticed was, and you know, that for instance, okay, in you know, in the book, you bring to light choices that you made in your life, and how that affected you at other parts in your life and stuff. So what could you tell listeners or young people about, you know, the choices that you made when you were younger and how it later affected your life?
Yeah, that's a tough one. How do you do that? And I think there are some people that don't think about that much. They just forge ahead, you know, and they make the last minute decisions or something. I'm one of those people, unfortunately, that always, you know, look at whatever choice I have and then try and figure out the best choice. I remember even in college, you know, what course am I going to take next semester? Like, as if my life depended upon it. Would it be better to take the course of the history of the British Empire or modern day American history, whatever it was, you know, what would be the worst, because somehow that was going to affect the rest of my life. But then finally you just had to make a decision, you know, and so that's, then later on, it's some things would just fall in my pathway, and I would know that that's the right thing to do. But when you're young, you don't always know that, and you have to make a decision. Sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it's not. But then sometimes years go by and you look back. I look back on my life now and I can say, you know, all those things that happened all together, they turned out to be the best thing that I could have done. You know, there was no other choice really that would have been better. You know? So
yeah, but what I'm saying is that through Kate, I think you know, by talking about the choices and then showing how they affected in the short term and how they affected 13 years later,
that's right.
It provides an educational component. So as I'm reading it, as I said earlier, I'm reading it as, you know, as a baby boomer and I'm feeling like, oh yeah, I remember that and stuff, but I'm also seeing how a younger reader can be reading this and go, oh, see how that now created something else that happened 13 years later.
That's right. You know? That's right.
Anyway, so that's why I'm saying there's so much more. And I'm wondering if that comes from the fact of having written documentaries. It's about educating people as well as entertaining or providing, you know, more information.
I think so. It is difficult to know what choice to make. And sometimes you just have to go with it. And sometimes there are consequences that you have to then resolve, you know. And I think in this instance, that's what Kate has to do, because she makes a decision based on something she didn't really want to have to make that decision. And somehow she's unable to come to a resolution with him. She tries to bury it, wants to ignore it, wants to just go on with her life and not think about it. And yet it's still there, it's still festering. And at some point she realizes that this is something I have to deal with to move on. And that probably happens for a lot of people, I would think, you know, if it's a traumatic thing that happens. One of my friends read the book and she never really said about what it was that had bothered her, that was traumatic to her. But she ended her review of the book by saying that it was better therapy than any therapist she'd gone to. So just reading about that, I think, is an interesting thing for young people to see that process that goes along and what can happen if you bury it, or if you're ashamed of it, or if you're afraid to tell anyone else, or thinking somebody will think badly of you, or whatever it is, that Kate has to learn that she is herself, you know, and that's who she is, and she doesn't have to be ashamed of it. She doesn't have to be afraid of it. she can go on with it and be positive about her life and learn from it. You know, I think that's what happened.
Has anybody talked to you about turning it into a screenplay?
Yes. I'm hoping
As I was reading it, I could see that. I mean, I could feel that.
Yeah. Well, I've been told that a lot, you know. And when I write, though, I feel like I'm watching a movie. You know, I write as if I'm watching a movie, and that's how I describe it. And I think that's how it turned out. Yeah, so I'm hoping. I actually had been told first while I was still trying to find publishing for it that I should do that it would be great as a limited series. And so I have a pilot already script, and I have a proposal. So if anyone's interested out there, please get in touch.
They need to read the book so that they can see who the characters are.
That's right.
And get a good feel for it. And yeah, I think that would be great. I had that same feel.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about Paris itself.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting. I saw a movie that some friends were in, and I wrote about it, and I put it out there. I published it just as, you know, a review type of thing. Uh-huh. And I referred to it as, it was a love letter to Los Angeles. Uh-huh. And what it made me think of was, this was kind of like a love letter to Paris, or a love letter of Paris in the past.
Uh-huh.
So, because it seemed like, I mean, you brought Paris to life, you know, with your descriptions. But this was Paris in the 60s and 70s. How easy was it for you to recall these times? Is most of your descriptions, is this from memory? Did you have to go back and Google Paris in the 60s and 70s to refresh your memory? How did this work?
Uh-huh. Well, some of both, I think. I did Google things just to get specifics to make sure that was right, like in terms of how much did it cost to buy a hot dog in Paris, and you won't believe it, or how much, you know, what was our rent? When I went with a girlfriend at first, you know, what did we pay the hotel room? She had written to her parents and had saved that letter. So I knew how much, you know, it cost every night, $2.50, something like that.
Yeah, I know. That was one of the things that struck me as well of, you know, it just kind of reminded me. Then I started thinking about the inflation and everything else.
But again, there were things that were, just how did I first fall? Somebody asked me, how did I first fall in love with Paris? And one of the things I found in my box of letters was a letter I'd written to a friend. I guess I was starting in the summer school there. And I wrote to her that I had just come out of the metro to Concord, which is this very busy place, if you know Paris, where cars are going every which way, and mm-hmm. there's all these beautiful buildings surrounding it, and you can see the bridge and the Seine and the Eiffel Tower right next to it. And it just hit me, because I had been wandering around that day, I guess, not knowing what to do with myself. And it just hit me. I was in Paris. What you dream about all your life. And if you've seen the movie Gigi, or you've seen the movie Breathless, or you've seen, you know, all these movies,
right.
you dream about it. And all of a sudden it hit me. I was there. And it was just magical. And how to describe it is difficult. But it was the cars going every which way, as I said. The policemen in their little caps that back in the 60s that they wore, with the capes, and directing traffic, and these beautiful buildings that had been built in the 19th century that all look so harmonious. And you can't really say specifically what it was, but it was just captivating. But there I was, and I was there, and I wanted to immerse myself in it. I wanted to be there, but then how did I do that? What did I do? And then from there, you just kind of naturally begin to believe that you're actually living there. But I think that is something magical, because each time I've gone back, I get back there and I feel that same kind of little shiver, you know, when I see the Eiffel mm-hmm. Tower, or I'm walking down the streets, or saying, bonjour, madame, merci, madame, and you're going to shop, you know. all of those little things. How do you describe it? It's just, I think maybe it is magic. I don't know if it's something specific or not.
Well, I'm one of those, I like coming of age type of things, or kind of a fish out of water type of things, if I'm reading or I'm watching. And that's kind of the feeling that I get when you're talking, when you're in the chapters that are the 60s, that, you know, there's a coming of age and a coming of age component, and at times a little bit of a fish out of water component too.
That's,
you know,
right.
So, you know, for those things, and again, as for those of you that are listening or watching, I think we get to a time in which we know what we like. And those were the feelings, you know, that I was getting was, yes, this is why I like this, because I can, you know, I can read along and feel like I'm there.
Did you feel those things that I was writing about?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what it's, again, it's what, you know, since I've been doing this podcast, a lot of my reading has shifted from reading for fun, reading for entertainment, to reading for knowledge, you know, because I would have a guest that is a world-renowned psychiatrist talking about something, or a world-renowned doctor talking about something that's going to help us live longer.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I think why I feel so great about this is that I was back to reading something that was so enjoyable, you know. I wasn't only going after knowledge. I was enjoying. I was able to dive in and become part of it.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that was my goal at the beginning. Although I'm so glad that you're saying this as a male, because I thought maybe this novel would only be more interesting to women because it's about a woman. I don't know, but my that's why I'm so glad that it reaches, you know, all genres. That I had, my goal was to write something that I wanted to read, you know, that I wanted to have fun with reading. And I used to call it a smart woman's beach read. That's what I wanted. Something that was fun, that was, you know, romantic, that was humorous, that was a little sexy, but also it had some significance to it, you know, that all of a sudden you are in another world and some other things happen, you know, that Kate has to deal with. And that's life. What I wanted to write, you know, people say, what genre is it? They all say that about every script you ever write. You know, what's your genre? Is it sci-fi? Is it young adult? Is it children's? What is it? Is it romance? And for me, it's really hard to classify it. Why can't you just have, it's about life. That's what it is. that's what my goal was. And I hope, you know, that I think that's one of the things that maybe people would like, you know, because you can have fun and then you also delve a little deeper into your souls about it.
Well, we are speaking with award-winning writer Joan Meyerson, and we're talking about her first novel, Who Needs Paris? We're going to take a break. I want you to stay with us. You're listening to, or you're watching, Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We are talking about writing. We're talking about Paris. And we're talking about life. So, Joan, let's talk a little bit about Paris. Have you been, other than the two times you lived there, have you been back just to visit?
Oh yes. Well, for a while, long while, I didn't go back. But then I started going back. I had made in the 70s. I made some friends there. Actually, I had also made a friend back in the 60s. I had met her. I was with a girlfriend traveling, and we were in Greece, and we were at a youth hostel, and we met this lonely French girl who was there too. We ended up traveling with her, and 40 years later, however long it is, I still know her, still friends with her, which is nice. So I'd go visit her, and then I visited some other and stayed with some other another French woman that I had met that in the 70s. My friend and I, co-writer, we were in Club Med in Tahiti doing a project, and I met her there. And so I would start going back and staying with another American friend who's a painter and lived there. So I would go back and stay for a couple of weeks and with them, and really, it was really great because you felt like you were actually living in Paris. And so I did that. And
while we're speaking about Paris, I'm curious, it would appear that Patrice, the character of Patrice that Kate knows, could be patterned after someone. Is it patterned after someone, and do they know it?
It's true. I did, when I was making documentaries, someone recommended me to the Patrice character, because he was doing this series called Journal de Californie. And he had been a Vietnam, just as I have in the book, it's true, he had been a Vietnam correspondent during the Vietnam War, even though he was French, but I guess maybe he went back too when it was a French colony, Vietnam. And he would call me, every few months, every 6 months, maybe every month, maybe every year, you never knew when he would have a story that he wanted to film. And it was true. He felt that it was, that California was the place where all these new things were happening in the 70s. And he wanted to show France what was going on. And so that part was true. We remained friends too. I would visit him when I went to France, and I developed the story a lot. Right. There was not this girlfriend. There was not other things. I took parts of his personality that seemed to be right, and followed through with them. And also in terms of his experiences in Vietnam, why he didn't want to do anything about war anymore. He wanted to leave that. Had disturbed him that much.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Going back to Paris for a bit, again, you obviously love Paris. You have fallen in love with Paris. What do you think makes Paris so special? And do you think it's more or less special today or what it was 50 or 60 years ago?
Yes, well, I guess, special in its own way, I think. The 60s really were a time when things were not quite so free. It was really a sort of a bourgeois existence, middle class. Things had to be a certain way, and this is how you ate, this is how you did things, and there was it was a very strong moral situation, even though it was beginning to open up. I mean, you had like people like Sartre and Camus and all those intellectuals, going forward with new thoughts. But for the main people, most of the people were more middle class, I guess, and were more afraid to go out. And then by 1968, the students were rebelling. In the 68, that became a big thing, like just what happened in the United States. So I don't know, I guess, however it is, Paris has some kind of of an allure to it, I think, you know, whether it's because it's got students running around and police chasing them, or else you're going to very fancy restaurants and eating wonderful food, cuisine. So I think, you know, each era was different, but I found the 70s a lot more open and liberating and free, and for women especially too. I when I was there in the 70s, I met a lot of women filmmakers, writers. I interviewed Agnes Varda, which was a great privilege to do in Paris. So it had become a lot freer and a lot more opportunity, and they really had washed all the buildings. You know, the buildings were dark in the 60s, covered with soot. And when I got there in the 70s, I actually saw them pressure. They were out there like scrubbing all the dirt off the buildings, and they were new again. And I think that's was part of the charm and magic in the 70s, because you had all these old buildings, but you were living in them. So you could kind of transport yourself back to that time when they were new.
Well, again, as I'd mentioned earlier to the audience, or those that might have just joined us, you know, Joan is also an accomplished a TV writer, and especially in the documentary area. So now, having put your first novel out, which do you prefer? Do you prefer the TV, or do you have the fiction bug now?
Well, you know, I guess if you're presented, when you're at a restaurant and you're presented with, do you want the, you know, the ice cream, or do you want the pineapple upside down cake, you know? Yeah. And what I would say is, can I have a little of both, please?
There you go.
So yeah. I really if someone came to me with this great documentary idea and wanted to do it, I would love to do it, you know, but I haven't been out looking for it. At the time, I think I was ready to do something different and new. And there is something about creating your own world out of your, you know, that I think I love. So I would, if I ever had a chance, I mean, I've got a couple of proposals of documentaries that almost got made but didn't. And if I ever had a chance to, I would love to do that if it was, you know. There's the one that I wanted to do on, it's about the legacy of animals. And I think it's getting more and more important is to show that they, all of their emotions into what it was to sort of show the humans and the animals, each one going through the stages of life and seeing the similarities to all of it, you know, how you raise a baby, your little lion cub, what happens when the elephants become teenagers and they get drunk on eating the tree, the fruit from the trees, and how do they deal with death? There's so many things that are similar, and we need to know that, and that's why we need to save our animals.
Well, it looks like a perfect fit for Animal Planet or Discovery.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So anyway, I like, you know, I just said both, but I'll probably start with it. The nice thing about writing a novel is it's just you and your computer. As long as your computer works, then you can keep going. You don't need
I like it. Now, as I was kind of looking into, you know, the things that you've done, and I noticed that you also served on the Writers Guild board. Uh-huh. So if you don't mind me changing the subject for a little bit, I think anybody who knows anything about this industry knows that there was a strike going on for quite some time. What would you say were the biggest obstacles in settling the recent WGA strike and the SAG strike?
Okay, you know what? This is going to sound funny, but I'm going to start with a quote that I always use. And so if you know, in the 30s, there was a man named Irving Thalberg, who was a head of MGM production and also produced, I think, some of his own movies. And he did wonderful movies. But what he said was, I'm trying to look for the quote because I want to say the right thing, you know. Let me see. I have notes here. I want to say if I can say it exactly. I have so many pieces of paper here. Just 1 minute. Ah, yeah. This is his quote back in the 30s. This is, if it isn't for the writing, we got nothing. Writers are the most important people in Hollywood, and we can never let them know it. So what the problem is, you can say, what is the biggest problem or what is the biggest change?
Or the biggest obstacle, you know.
Is to believe in yourself and to be able to unite together. So I was on the board in the 2007-2008 strike. And when I first started, when I was first starting on the board, that was back in the early 2000s and even in the 90s, I think I was in a term. I was on board at that time. And I think writers were afraid. I think they believed some of this, that they could only get as much as they could get. And they were afraid to keep going. And they, you know, they didn't really believe in themselves. And I think then when I got on in the 2000s, where I was with some people and our president, Patrick Barone, who were much clearer on what the goal should be and that we needed to unite and we needed to do all these things. Now, this is my own personal opinion. Everybody may have something different, but I could see that as I was living it, that that people were beginning to do that. And then this year, when I picketed along with them, I could see how clear everybody was on supporting what they needed. And I think that finally, you know, you probably heard, you know, some of these, like the Disney head, Bob Iger, saying, you know, what do these people want anyway, you know? they felt that they would be able to, you know, to stop it and feel, you know, say that you're asking for too much, you're not being realistic. And meanwhile, they're making billions of dollars. And I think finally, writers realized that we are important and we need to be treated equally and justly.
Well, I like that. You know, one of the things that was interesting me because it's something I didn't know that much about, but AI seemed to be a huge issue in the strike negotiations. What's your thoughts on AI as we move forward?
Ugh, it's scary. That's just my thought. It's very scary. And I don't really, you know, I did one quick little fun attempt at it when I was, because the title of my book, by the way, has had like four different titles, you know, I finally ended up with this one. And I was looking for a new title. And right at the time when people were beginning to play around with GPT, chat GPT, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I thought, all right, well, let me see what kind of title they can bring out. And, you know, it was all kind of a cliche titles, and there was one or two that I thought, well, they might work okay. And so I Googled them, and there were four or five books with the same title. So that's where AI had gotten their intelligence, you know. Mm-hmm. They Googled something, you know. You could do that too. So luckily, I came up with my own title. So I think there's still a human element that they don't have and will never have. They could be a tool, just like using Google as a tool. I mean, or Wikipedia, you know, we all can get, we don't have to have so many books around. We can check out facts that way. But when it comes down to it, and we need to have our own, you know, our own things. And I just think that is scary if they were to take over, I think. It's not fair. It's not equal. It's not even good artistically.
Well, and again, I agree with that as well. Mm-hmm. I think my concern, because when I've discussed this with people, and a couple of times people have said, "Well, there's nothing to worry about. It's just an algorithm."
Yeah.
And I said, "But the problem that I see is who's feeding the algorithm, because they're feeding it as facts."
That's right. And
which means that whichever humans are controlling it at that point, it's their fact. And we're seeing with all of the things going on around the world, there's a pretty wide stretch of what people believe is a fact or is a truth And anyway, so that's my concern. So I was curious because I know that they kept bringing up AI as one of the big issues.
It is. Well, also because they could, with AI, you know, potentially you can get rid of almost all those people, you know, and they're going to lose their jobs, and you're just going to end up with mediocre shows and mediocre actors. And the actors, you know, it's a big, big deal for the actors too. That's why they stayed on strike so long. So now they do say, you know, you have to get their permission, you have to pay them, you have to do this, that. I hope that's true.
Well, I just glanced at the time and I can't believe we have blown by. We've only got about 2 minutes. But without giving too much away, what's one way Kate's journey in Paris helps her find redemption and self-discovery?
What's one way? I think she has the freedom to realize that as she's working for this Patrice, and she's like his associate producer, that she is actually doing the work. And the longer she stays in Paris, the more she feels empowered to do what she really wants to do and not be afraid of it. And finally, after some of the interviews that she does at the Deauville Film Festival, and she tries it out and she finds out that, yeah, you know what? I know how to do this and I can do this. And I'm a woman who wears Armani. And everyone can read to find out what that means.
Yes. But also, that's such a great point, because that's kind of what I was bringing up earlier when I was saying that I can envision younger women, more in particular, but most anybody, but mostly younger women reading this and growing with it and realizing at the same time that Kate is realizing and going, you know what? I can do this. And I can see them being able to get some self-discovery, which then would lead to some self-empowerment.
That's right. You know, I think it is all in that. Just like as I was talking about the writers who weren't believing in their power, women have to do that. And even if it doesn't succeed at the beginning, you know, it will. And you know, I ran for Writers Guild president and I didn't win, and I knew I wouldn't win. But it was important to show that a woman was running, I thought, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I did it.
Well, Joan, I got to tell you, thank you so much for coming on, but also thank you for writing this book. And again, you know, it's rejuvenated me in being able to read something that was so enjoyable on so many different levels. So I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope other people will feel the same way and go out and take a look at it. Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. And it's also, as you say, and that's what I'm so appreciative of, that you really saw that. You really saw that this can help all of us, not just women, but women, you know, because, like Kate, who need to see that they are worth it, and they don't have to be ashamed of whatever, you know, or feel that they're not. And then they can take their trip to Paris and enjoy it.
Exactly. Now, for everybody out there, again, the book, you can get the book anywhere books are sold. Joan, if anybody would like to get in touch with you, especially the person that's out there that wants to finance your next project, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, first of all, I have a website. So yes. It's just Joan Meyerson, but remember there's an E in Meyerson because a lot of people don't know that. JoanMeyerson.com. And there's a lot of, it's a fun website because it does have, you can click on Paris and see lots of photographs. And also you can see some photographs of other jobs that I worked on, especially the one that I am most honored to have is, from the Memorial Day concert, because I used to write Colin Powell's speech every year. And so this picture would be with Colin Powell. And then I did win an award. You can also click on this if you want to. I won an award from the Writers Guild for service. And unbeknownst to me, they videotaped my speech. So you can watch. You can click on that. And you can, anyway, and also, but there's a little click that says contact me. And you just write your name and what you want to say, a little message, and that will come directly to me.
Again, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. And for everybody out there, please be with us next week when we're joined by Lisa Barnett as she discusses her new book, Akashic, Your Soul Has a Plan. Now, if you're not familiar with this term, I suggest you Google it. And if you do, you won't want to miss this show. Please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network or just subscribe to the show through YouTube, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. Helps us reach more people, and I want you to know I greatly appreciate it. The next time you're on Instagram, Facebook, or X, or Twitter, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.